ABA Inside Track, the podcast that's like reading in your car, but safer. I'm your host, Robert Perry Cruz, and this is episode 18, Moving from A to B and Problems with Transitions. I'm here with my fabulous co-hosts as well.
I'm Diana.
And I'm Jackie. Hey, everyone.
Hi. I'm really proud of you guys, because if you didn't notice, I changed my SD for when you're supposed to come in. I put it in a different order, so you're really paying attention to that key component. Co-host. You hear the word co-host, and you're moving.
Yeah.
It's a good job.
That's right. I tune out until then.
I eat M&Ms. Yep.
Well, as I said at the beginning, today we are talking about transition-related problem behavior, or issues with transition, I guess, more specifically. For those of you who are new to our show, we are a podcast in which we read research on behavior analytic topics, and then we discuss it. Sort of like, you know, an old-fashioned journal club get-together brouhaha.
In case you don't
have a local one, we're here to help. Our topic tonight really deals with the issue of going from one place to another place. And I know for a lot of you who work with students with autism, a lot of times transitions can be a very challenging time. I think a lot of time, the reason we discuss it as being an issue is this sort of uncertainty. And children with disabilities, specifically autism, have an uncertainty about transitioning. And while that could be the case, it's not always the function of their behavior to escape some sort of uncertainty in life with a transition. There's an article that is on the website, but we're not going to be discussing it tonight. But it's Advance Notice for Transition-Related Problem Behavior, Practice Guidelines, by Brewer, Strickland, Cohen, Dotson, and Williams in Behavior Analysis and Practice 2014. And that's a great overview article that goes into the idea of how do we signal transitions? Why might we signal transitions? Is transitioning inherently an issue of going from a place that you know where everything is to a place of uncertainty? Or is there something else, like I physically don't like going places because that's work, or I like what I'm doing, and when you say let's go do something, odds are it's something that I will hate? And it really comes down to about, you know, two breakdowns into why children have trouble with transitions. One is that uncertainty. The other is I don't really want to go there. And we'll be talking about two articles tonight that get into those two main functions with a little more detail. So our first article tonight will be Functional Analysis and Treatment of Self-Injury Associated with Transitions by McCord, Thompson, and Iwata from the Journal of Applied Behavior Analysis in 2001. And our second article, a little bit more recent one, Decreasing Transition Times in Elementary School Classrooms Using Computer-Assisted Instruction to Automate Intervention Components by Hine, Ardoin, and Foster in the Journal of Applied Behavior Analysis from 2015. So let's start with our 2001 article. And Jackie, you're taking the lead on this one, so why don't you?
I sure am. Sounds great.
Our ears are open. We're ready to go.
So before we talk about these articles, I was thinking about transitions the other day as I was driving to work, as I was transitioning.
Because it's fall.
It's fall. But also transitioning from my cozy couch where I was sitting with my two dogs drinking a hot cider, then transitioning to my work where it was cold and the AC is still on.
Oh no.
And I was thinking about how kids aren't the only, you know, species that have problems with transitioning.
Definitely not.
You know, like, think about all of you having the best vacation of your life, loving vacation, loving Disney World, because that's where you went, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. It's the most relaxing place
on Earth. Yes, so relaxing. I've only been there once, but I can imagine it's very relaxing. And then having to, like, come home and then go to work the next day and maybe being off for a week to 2 weeks, but not checking your email.
Mm.
Yeah.
So that's a very hard transition that adults face. And I was just thinking about the different types of transitions in my life that I find increasingly difficult.
Mm-hmm.
To go through, and the problem behavior that I have. So I think that it's something interesting that when we pull into the dissemination station, we shouldn't forget to talk about the studies that we should be doing on adult behavior in everyday life, like transitioning back from lunch.
I think transitioning out of the bed
Oh, that's the worst.
It's probably the hardest one of everything.
Especially when you put the flannel sheets on for the first time.
Well, then you're literally, like, stuck in the bed.
Yeah. It's like, can't it's get like out. Velcro. But, yeah, so I was just thinking about that because as I started reading this article, they talk about transitions as, you know, moving from one activity to another. It doesn't necessarily have to be a setting, but it can be.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot that goes into transitions when you think about them.
Yeah. It's stopping an activity and starting a new activity. I know you're going to talk about that in depth, but what always amazes me is that trying to get the kids into the tub is really difficult. And then just as difficult is getting them out of the tub. So it's not anything about taking a bath itself. It's just moving, transitioning between the two activities and stopping what you were doing before and starting something new.
Yeah, and so one of the things that McCord talks about in his introduction is that throughout the day, we engage in transition behavior 20 to 35% of our time, which may be more if you have a longer commute or more children, for instance. So it's just like kind of, it's like crazy that we don't have like a ton of research on something that's so...
I totally believe it, though.
Oh, yeah. Ubiquitous. Is that the right word?
Yeah.
It totally happens, it's ubiquitous. All over the place, all over the time.
Very I always want to use that word, and I never use it the right way. So it's just really interesting to think about.
It's one of those problems that I don't think anyone thinks about until it is a problem.
Right.
Because I'm sure, and Dinah, your article goes a lot into this, I'm sure that everyone could be way better at transitions. And if we calculated how much time we kind of spend dawdling or, oh, I forgot that, let me go back and get it. Or like, I think I have time for one more email. I bet you could probably say, wow, I'm wasting across a year of employment. I probably waste 4 or 5 hours or some crazy amount of time that you think, oh, it's not very much. I get my job done. No one's mad about it. But there is a lot of lost time there. But unless you're performing, you're not having challenging behavior that anyone notices, it's not really an issue.
You can increase your own productivity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so what they were looking at in the literature before 2001 is a lot of antecedent-based interventions. So trying, not necessarily looking at the consequence or why problem behavior is occurring during these transitions, but how they could alter the environment to maybe decrease the probability that problem behavior is going to occur. So that's what they were doing before 2001, before this article came out. So that was pretty interesting. One of the first articles that looked at transition was a girl who had intellectual disabilities. She had a problem transitioning from one classroom to the bus. So they hypothesized that it was access to attention. And although they didn't complete a functional analysis, what they found is when they put a treatment based on attention in the typical setting, problem behavior reduced, which is neat, even in the absence of extinction.
That's nice.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I know.
Good
I was like, wow.
So that was one of the first attempts at doing a function-based assessment for transitions? Okay.
Yeah.
And before that, when you talk about antecedent strategies, you mean using like first then schedule or some
or
type of visual
a bell,
component? Okay.
Giving a warning.
Mm-hmm.
One of the coolest things they talk about, too, is these two articles that looked at very specific before, like way before the transition happened, that had the probability of increasing the problem behavior. It was the Kennedy and Ekkonen, 1993, whose problem behavior was not related to the transition, but events that occurred prior to the transition. So one of the participants, if she got out of bed 5 minutes after the alarm rang, then she would have problems transitioning. Huh. So they made a contingent. Isn't that interesting, though? Like, how did they figure that out?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. So they made this treatment based on if she gets out of bed within the 5 minutes that her alarm goes off, she receives some sort of reinforcement for getting out of bed, and then her transitions are significantly better throughout the day, which is amazing. And then the other participant had problem behavior when her bus traveled a particular route to school.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So when they changed, they altered the bus route, then she had more favorable transitions throughout the day, just based on that, like, small antecedent change, which is so crazy because...
It's so idiosyncratic. Like,
right. Like, how did you figure that out? Like, I was reading it, and I was like, I want to be there when you're like, aha! It is the bus route.
I've solved it!
And then other things they talk about introduction is to, like Harab pointed out earlier, is that it could be that transitions are difficult because they're unpredictable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So maybe using some signaling cues, such as an auditory cue, a visual cue, prior to the transition to signal those upcoming transitions may help.
Mm-hmm.
And research is fairly mixed there. So sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but people have been giving it a shot for a while.
It makes sense. If you're not sure what's happening next, then you might see some type of behavior that could be categorized as anxious behavior surrounding the transition, right? So providing visual cues or additional warning stimuli would help ease into that transition.
Right.
But on the flip side, if you don't have any trouble understanding what the transition means, if you don't like what's going to happen when the transition occurs, then being given that warning is just going to give you more time to anticipate this upcoming transition that you don't like.
Right. So actually, the McCord article looks at a portion of that by signaling the transition in one of their treatment components, as well as their main function here was to look at the role of consequences in maintaining problem behavior during transitions. So I think that's pretty cool since no one has done it before. They had three phases, I guess they're calling it. They did a preference assessment first, where they looked to see some preferred activities and edibles that they could use as a preferred activity to go to or leave.
Okay.
And then they also looked at aversive activities. So they did an assessment to try to pinpoint activities that participants found aversive. So that they could
either... Let's be honest, like, these aversive types of activities occur in everybody's day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
you have to take a shower.
Right.
Go to work. Put your shoes on. Like, these are all things that just... It cannot be avoided.
Absolutely. Yeah, those can't be avoided. And it could be...
Brush your hair.
Yeah, so they wanted to really look at, is it going from a pleasant to a pleasant situation, a pleasant to an unpleasant situation? But when you hit there, you're never sure if it's actually positive reinforcement or negative reinforcement. You know, that's at play there. Mm-hmm. So instead of doing that, what they did, which I think is ingenious, is they had participants going from a neutral activity, doing nothing, to a positive activity, a neutral activity, doing nothing, to a negative, aversive activity, and then switched it. So they went from a positive activity to nothing and an aversive activity to nothing. And they also looked at if going to a location, a different location, was going to affect transition behavior. So they had all of those different scenarios and then looked at going to location versus staying in the same place, which I think is pretty neat. But yeah, so they use those preference assessments and the avoidance assessment or the aversive assessment to pick those activities. One thing they did say, though, is that the assessment they looked at to find aversive activities wasn't as successful as they wanted it to be. They couldn't get conclusive results, so they didn't really give us a lot there. But that's okay. But I actually was like, oh, you got me wanting more. Like, I wanted to see why it didn't work or, like, what you found. It was basically like, it didn't work. But we're just going to pick some potentially aversive activities based on, you know, informal observations and
Do you think they hate questions. This task? Do you think they hate this chore? You do? Okay, great. Yeah, that's good. We got that.
Right? Yeah. So that was pretty interesting.
Everybody hates folding laundry. I'll throw that in there.
Everybody hates brushing their teeth. It's true, though. Most people do.
Yeah.
I didn't brush. Tidbit. I don't do it. Yeah, tidbit for me. I didn't brush my teeth for like 1 year when I was a child. Mm. I refused to brush my teeth, and so my mom.
Let
go. Bad actually. My mom brushed my teeth in the middle of the night when I was sleeping.
No.
Oh yeah, because I refused to brush my teeth.
Wow.
And
did she just feed you a lot of carrots and stuff?
No, I was...
You know those, like, doggy dental
She gave me some greenies. She gave me some greenies to clean my teeth out. So now I'm faced with lots of cavities. I have tons of cavities in my mouth because of this 1 year of refusing to brush my teeth. I guess you can't really get a lot when your child is sleeping.
I guess you can't really.
You can't really get those back teeth very well.
No, without, you know, like, making them gag and waking up.
Oh, man.
So I can relate.
Yeah, you probably should have had an intervention.
Yeah, I probably should have, but, you know,
knows? They could have just interviewed your mom and be like, that's one, we'll put that in there.
Yeah.
No more assessment needed.
Yeah. So another thing I think that's cool about this study is that they used two individuals who lived in state residential facilities, and they seemed fairly low functioning.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I'm reading it here. So one was a 27-year-old man who had intellectual disabilities and engaged in self-injurious behavior. He used a wheelchair and required assistance from staff.
Mm-hmm.
And he had head hitting, which is something you don't really want to happen because his caused swelling to his left eye.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's something that you really want to get rid of.
He was visually impaired as well.
Oh, yeah, he was.
They don't say if that's due to the self-injury or not.
Right. Probably, though.
We don't know.
We don't know, though. And the other participant was a 38-year-old man named Michael who had profound intellectual disabilities. He was ambulatory, but he did some hand biting. And he had to use protective equipment to prevent tissue breakdown. But they had very limited expressive repertoires and some receptive language skills. But so they were on the lower end of the functioning level. Which is interesting, too, because I think that's helpful since they can't tell us
exactly
why they don't like transitions. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a really applicable place to start using FAs to predict why problem behaviors are occurring during transitions.
Yeah.
The sessions were conducted in several locations throughout the typical environment for both participants. So, you know, transitions involving going from their bedroom to the dining room to work sessions everywhere throughout their residential facility. So I think that's helpful. So they did the preference assessment. They used an interesting paired preference assessment for visually impaired participants for Hayden, where they had him reach out. We physically guided him to, well, we didn't, but the researchers physically guided him to touch each item and then reach out for one. And Michael used the MSWO to find his preferred item. Then they did this avoidance assessment, and I really just love it. They're like, an attempt was made to identify a non-preferred ADL, but we couldn't really figure it out. But they did, so they just chose one. And then they ran the functional analysis. Here at the functional analysis, they had the different types of transitions involving the different types of activities, and the transitions included activity initiations and activity terminations. So that, I think that's important. And they looked at transitions or the target activities of both preferred and non-preferred activities, both food activities and leisure activities, and social interaction, because that's obviously included in most transitions.
Mm-hmm.
For these participants. Yeah. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And they had to do so many. So they had to do, I think, 20 transitions, right? Yeah. Because they had to go from each neutral activity to preferred activity, changing locations. Neutral activity to preferred activity, not changing locations. Neutral activity to aversive activity, changing locations. So they had to go through all of them, which I think is so crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And they had two locations.
Right.
To go through. So, like, they really thought about this. I was like, impressive.
Yeah, they did a really good job.
They weren't willy-nilly.
Every permutation of transitions, yeah.
We did that. I had a student who we used this on because we were having an issue with transitions. And I think I cut down the total number of transitions. And when I was trying to explain it, when I was trying to write it down so I could sort of like write a protocol everyone would understand, I had to draw so many charts of, okay, it's like a battleship board. Like, here's preferred to non-preferred number one and preferred to or neutral to non-preferred and neutral to preferred. And then there's a transition component. And I was trying to explain it and people were just sort of staring at me. I was like, no, it's really easy. I just kind of wrote it out.
It looked like these are the different ones.
Right.
No, eventually I just wrote it out as like, there are going to be about 10 different types. There's this to this with a move, this to this without a move, this to this. And I sort of broke it down that way. And then it made sense. But they all seemed very happy when I'd watched them running it. They all seemed really excited to have these kind of transitions to run. And so everyone seemed to enjoy the overall experience.
Well, that's good.
I didn't get a social validity check with anyone. But usually if I say we're doing an assessment, everyone's still smiling as they go through it. I assume it was at least like a 3 or 4 on the Likert scale. Yeah,
you got an informal approval.
Exactly.
Yeah. As you said, it's a ubiquitous problem.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone's appreciative when it's attempted to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I mean, in this case, you have the adults who are, you know, engaging in severe SIB.
Right.
But even if it's a student who's just won't leave the chair. They're being non-compliant. They're flopping. Maybe they're swiping or whining. It still is so clearly difficult, and it still adds so much time out of instruction, out of productive activities.
Mm-hmm. Right. And pretty crazy.
Creates avoidant behavior on the part of the teacher as well.
Right.
If we can just brush your teeth here and at your desk, that's fine. Let's just do it here. I just got to check off that we did it. Where doesn't matter to
generalization me. Generalization doesn't matter. As long as your teeth are clean. One thing I liked here, too, is that when they started the transition, if SAB occurred, then the session was terminated. So I think that's important to note that they didn't continue with the transition because they're not looking at how many times SAB occur. Mm-hmm. They're like, does SAB occur when this transition happens?
Right.
And like when it happens. Does it happen during the transition or within 2 minutes of the activity, the start of the activity? Mm-hmm. That's what they did.
We mentioned SIB and the session, but they also pretty much ran that kind of like a typical FA in terms of if SIB occurred and they were, you know, leaving an activity, they got the activity again,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
So, yeah. So, if SAB occurred and they were leaving a preferred activity, then they were allowed to resume that current activity for the 2 minutes, the preferred activity. Mm. So, it was very similar to like a typical FA condition.
Yeah. And the same with the demand presentation?
They got to escape the demand, yeah.
Okay.
So, good to know.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Good little tidbit there. So they ran the transition, they ran the activity for 2 minutes, and then if SIB occurred, the session was terminated, and if it did not, they ran whatever activity it was for 2 minutes, and then the session was over. So I thought that was nice.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't invoke SIB for a long period of time.
Yeah.
The topography of the assessment actually looked a lot like when we were talking about trial-based FAs.
Let's
do this, and then do something, something switches, and then do this, and behavior starts, you're done. Just move along.
Yeah. Because they just looked at whether problem behavior occurred during transitions or whether it occurred during that activity, they used a bar graph, which we don't always see, but I love. And so what they did is they looked at
cliff jumping.
I know. I can jump over all my little bars.
It's like each session basically had a plus or a minus.
Right.
For occurrence, non-occurrence.
So one thing I love about the graph is that they are graphing the percentage of transitions with SIB across location change as a dark gray bar and no location change as a striped bar across the various activities. So no activity, adding an aversive activity, taking away aversive activity to that neutral activity. And they did it across multiple activities.
Mm-hmm.
So for Hayden, they had wipe table and brush teeth. And then they had their food and leisure and social. And what they found for Hayden was across the board, we saw elevated levels of SIB occurring in transitions when there was a location change for all of them.
Yep.
Which is amazing. I think only one of them is less than
80%. Right. Which is going to food.
Right. Going to food. But even there, it's like 70-something. So that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Fairly low levels of percentages of transitions with SIB when there's no location change. Mm. So here, generally, they said, although there is some levels, there's something else going on. Mostly, they're thinking it's this change of activity or change of location that's probably producing problem behavior in these contexts. For Michael, he had slightly different results.
Mm-hmm.
He, as well, saw elevated levels, although not to the degree of Hayden's, when there was a location change and less when there was no location change. However, they noticed that when told to pick up or brush teeth, he had problem behavior exclusively during the condition.
Mm-hmm.
So when the demand was placed on him. So they figured that problem behavior not only occurred during transitions, but also served as an escape function for that specific demand. Mm-hmm. So cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They like really worked on it pretty hard, I think.
It's good. I mean, I like how much it captured that even if, you know, you're going to get the transition, you're going to get the movement in the environment or not movement in the environment, but you still have a means of getting a decent amount of information as to, well, maybe it's one of our traditional conditions of escape or access to attention. I mean, in this case, it was just the escape, but.
Right. And so I think what I love about these articles, too, is once they do that assessment, then they follow it up with a treatment evaluation. So they did a treatment evaluation for location change transition only for Hayden. And what they did is they actually ran the advance notice first.
Mm-hmm.
So gave them an advance notice that the transition was occurring. And they saw 100% transitions with SIB when the advance notice, which is higher than baseline levels. It's like across the board. And they ran a lot of sessions. Ooh. It's not just three. It's like more than five sessions. So in 100% of times that they're like, in 2 minutes, we're going to make this transition.
Yeah.
There was problem behavior.
Yeah.
Then they implemented a DRA. Still saw elevated levels of problem behavior during transitions. And then they implemented a DRA plus extinction, mm-hmm. plus a blocking response. And only then did they see a decrease in problem behavior during transitions down to near zero levels. Yeah.
Yeah. Extinction really works.
Extinction really works.
I know. I'm glad they started with something else, though, because I know, and I've seen Dr. Iwata talk about, is extinction a bad thing? Because I more and more hear it as this kind of, oh, we shouldn't do that or don't do that. And I always get, I just feel so nervous about it so much.
When you're talking about severe problem behavior, I mean, reinforcement's great, and that's where we should always start, but sometimes it is only going to get you so far, and you need to break that existing response-reinforcer relation. Yeah.
As quickly as possible.
Yeah, I know. I'm rarely in a situation, I think, when I'm called upon to do something that's so severe, and I usually work with younger students where even the severest behavior, as long as it's not SIB, is, you know, oh, I'll just kind of, I can block that. That's okay. Oh, you're on the ground. We'll get there eventually. No, I know, I know. I'm very honest about with the people. Like, I want to do extinction, but I'm not going to do it yet. We'll come to it, everybody. When I see a look on your faces of none of this is working and you don't know what you're doing, I'll throw the extinction in. That'll be my signal.
You need to have buy-in from the teachers.
Yeah. You do have to have buy-in. And it's difficult. Extinction is really hard, especially in a public school setting, because maybe implement your procedures with high procedural integrity during the school day, but all's fair when kids go home. So, I mean, they're going to come contact some sort of reinforcement if that behavior is occurring at home as well. So it does get a little more tricky in your situation. But when they looked at Michael, so they looked at two problem behaviors during transition, walking and picking up. And they, again, saw similar results to Hayden, where given the advance notice, they still saw elevated levels of problem behavior. Mm-hmm. They only saw a decrease in behavior with low levels and very low variability, and a decreasing trend when they did the DRA plus extinction plus blocking. Mm.
Mm-hmm. So advanced notice did not work for either of these participants.
So, yeah, it did not replicate any of their previous results showing or previous studies showing that advanced notice work. And they posited that maybe it was because of the functioning level of the participants within this specific study. So they said that the first study that looked at advanced notice was Turin in like 1985, I think, and that student had more of a vocal-verbal repertoire.
Yeah,
so maybe there was more understanding there, and not necessarily the case here. But they obviously haven't looked at that. Maybe,
but when I try and tell our 5-year-old that he has 2 more minutes for iPad, I think he just spends those 2 minutes thinking about how he can hold on to the iPad when I come in and tell him that it's all done. Because he's very adept at, like, hugging it close to his body, like, flipping himself over. I probably should address this maybe in another way now that I'm saying it out loud.
Well,
anyway, I don't think advanced notice is working.
Right. And I don't think, in more current literature, I don't think it has been shown to be effective. I think it produces more.
It depends,
I guess. It's going to depend. Yes. But I've seen it, too, that, you know, when I was giving kids 1 more minute, then they would just stare at the timer until the 1 more minute had, like, clocked down. Mm-hmm. Or would look at the clock or be like, is 1 more minute over? Is 1 more minute over? Is 1 more minute over?
See, yeah. I always found the 1 more minute being almost like I broke the chain of the parents saying, all right, it's almost time. And then it's done. But I hate that it's done. And then when I teach the 1 more minute response, I just, instead of saying, hey, you're done, I'd be like, 1 more minute is done. And that sort of was like, oh, okay, sure. That's not this. It's just somehow changed that chain of behaviors. Yeah. If you tell me it's done, I'm going to have a problem. If you tell me my minute's done, for some reason, that doesn't bother me quite as much.
Well, that's good. I've not found the same results, but
I haven't actually taken data on that. It's more my anecdotal sense.
I encourage teachers, if they are teaching a child to ask for 1 more minute, to present the end of the activity, say, okay, iPad is all done. The child says, I want 1 more minute. And then, like you're saying, after that 1 minute is over, then they say, okay, your 1 minute is all done. So it's a different SD from the teacher.
Yep.
Right.
One of them is to ask for more time, and one of them is to relinquish control of the activity.
I've had a few. We've done some deep dives where staff just really were getting tired of the 1 more minute, and they said, well, I wanted to try something, so I just said, no sometimes.
Well, sometimes you have to say no.
And I didn't blame them because, they weren't saying no all the time. But they said no and some variation of no enough. And they continued to take really good data and they kept me in the loop. And I said, hey, you're here every day if you'd like to try that. And you're taking data. Let's see what happens. And it was relatively effective. I think it was good generalization practice.
I mean, that's what Hanley and colleagues in 2014 suggest, is that you should probably always incorporate a no into some sort of fading of your procedures, because we can't always say, yeah, you get one more minute, unfortunately, if it's a dangerous behavior,
it's just life.
Yeah. I wish I could always have one more minute.
Sometimes it's time to go. You're going to miss the bus.
That's true. But yeah, so I think this was a good article to start with, because it gives us that foundation of where we came from when we started looking at consequence-based interventions for problem behavior during transitions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a good one.
Yeah, I cite this one a lot because, I work a lot with children with autism, and a lot of times that sense of uncertainty, it can be very real, but it sort of becomes an explanation for a lot of behaviors related to transitioning between activities, transitioning through the environment. And this has been a really nice way to talk about how, that could be, but, and then be able to have a background as to if it's really a concerning behavior and just sort of the standard, praise for nice walking, reward when you get there, have an item with you. If that's not cutting it, we have a means of going through it that doesn't just result in, they hate this. They just hate this. What's the function? They hate moving. They hate transitions. They hate everything, which isn't really amenable to coming up with a great function-based treatment when that's kind of your crummy hypothesis. So it's been nice to have that, to be able to keep the discussion going.
Although they did find that was the function for Hayden.
Oh yeah, it totally can be. I'm not saying it's not.
He really did hate walking.
He really did.
The more we do this show, I think.
It was all about that.
The more we do the show, I think the more the answer is never, well, this is the thing. It's always, well, these are different things, and here's how to be critical about which thing is the right thing.
Right. And it's all about doing your work, basically. And not picking something that you think is going to work, but picking something that you know is going to work based on your assessment.
Yep.
Which I think is super important. And, by the way, something that is required by all behavior analysts as per our ethical guidelines.
But Jackie,
I'm teaching ethic right now, so we're doing in guideline 4.something something. Something. So
that's, Jackie, that's difficult. Which is difficult. Our first keyword of the evening.
Oh, snap.
You like that? Yeah. Difficult. So for those of you listening to the show, if it's your first time or if it's not, we are able to give continuing education credits for listening to the show. And you will have to have a couple things. It's all on the website and it's in the info blurb for this podcast. But you will need to know two keywords to demonstrate that you have listened to the show rather than downloaded it, immediately deleted it, and then asked for CEs, which of course no one would ever do, but just in case.
Yeah, don't do that.
No, don't do that. So the first keyword is difficult. D-I-F-F-I-C-U-L-T. Like, doing really good behavior analysis is super difficult. But hey, it's why we got into the field, because we love a challenge. So, difficult. Now, let's talk about something else that could be kind of difficult, which is getting kids in a classroom to move quickly between different tasks.
Oh, man. Can you imagine trying to teach a whole class of first or second graders and have them do something all at the same time?
No.
Mm-hmm.
I can't either. It makes me cringe. I, over the weekend, hung out with some young children, because remember, I don't have them.
Yes.
I hung out with two young children, and having them do two things at the same time, one thing at the same time, was like nearly impossible.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I can't imagine if you have like
20 to 25, even though they have like 8 to 15 years of experience as teachers, like, holy moly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good for them.
That's why we like 1-to-1.
Yeah, right. My max is like 30 undergraduates.
Right?
Yeah. And even that's challenging.
How do their transitions go?
Actually, most of the time they're transitioning quickly out of my classroom.
There you go.
Into the hallway for lunch. So, very well. Yeah.
Yeah. If I'm looking at more than one or two individuals and I'm trying to teach, at this point, it's usually like a training class or a group. And sometimes those can go up to, I usually don't have too many, but yeah, same as you, Jack, you're probably like maybe 20 to 30. And I like to do a lot of activities where, because, they're adults. I don't want them to just sit there for 2-3 hours. So we get up, we move around.
Yeah.
And usually they're pretty good at it, though. I have heard that they say, oh, I'd rather we not have to go anywhere.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to transition between places.
Oh, it's the worst, actually. So I make everyone get up and move and talk to different people because my class is early in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, like, my common feedback on my, like, midterm, like, evaluation was that it is too early to stand up and walk around. And I'm like, too bad.
My guess is it wasn't like, oh, if you let us sit, we'll pay better attention.
Right?
Like,
no.
You're not going to do anything.
Right. Yeah, right. You're going to stare off into space unless I swear or do something like that I'm not supposed to be doing so that you'll pay attention.
I had a history teacher in college that only taught classes at 8 a.m. I know, because he said that the students that would come to that class at 8 a.m. were the students that he wanted to teach.
Aww.
And he was really good.
Mm.
That was the thing. But he tied it all into, we talked about like European history, but in the context of post-apocalyptic literature.
Oh.
Yeah. So we read like six different, what is that called? Is that dystopia?
Dystopian is not necessarily novels. The same as post-apocalyptic, though.
Okay, well, I meant to say dystopian the first time. I just said the wrong thing.
Could be either one. They're both some nice examples of
books out there. And then we tied it into, it was a history class, but we read like six literature. It was a really good class.
Hmm.
Cool.
But it did happen at 8 a.m.
Hmm.
I hope you're so inspiring.
Yeah, I'm probably not. Okay.
All right, so for this article, I'm talking about decreasing transition times in elementary school classrooms, and they used computer-assisted instruction in order to present that treatment package, which was really cool.
Talk about your dystopian future with our computer-assisted instruction.
I know, it was real high-tech.
Yeah, I think this is actually, this is an article that would you would benefit from reading and also looking at the figures. Because when I was reading it, I was like, what are they talking about?
Mm.
But then I saw the figures and I was like, oh, that's what they're talking about now.
It's not that complicated.
It's not complicated at all, but reading it, it sounds very complicated. And so listening to Diana is actually going to sound very complicated, but it's actually not that complicated.
I'm going
to
hopefully present it.
Yeah.
It's not too complicated.
Okay, good. Because then I was reading it and I was like, what is happening? But yeah.
Yeah, but it's cool.
It's cool.
So cool. And it's different than what you've just talked about.
Because absolutely.
We're not delving deep into the function of the behavior here. We're really looking at how can we reduce time for first and second graders to transition between different centers' activities.
Yeah, I think the assumption is there's so many kids, it's going to be different functions. Generally, it's probably a sense of, why would I rush to the next thing?
You got to chat.
Just, yeah.
You got to talk to your friends.
Yeah, so it's not a consequence-based intervention.
No, it is largely antecedent strategies. There were group contingencies in place,
right,
too. So they did a little bit of manipulation there.
But, yeah.
But overall, no, they weren't not looking specifically at the function of the behavior. The authors, as you said, are Hine, Ardoin, and Foster. And this was in JABA 2015. So it was really focused on decreasing transition time, like I said, and they saw some definite advantages to doing that. And I appreciated them breaking it down for me because, of course, you know, I don't teach a class of 25 first or second graders.
No.
I think that would be too much for me. But as I kind of got more into thinking about what that would be like, the things that they mentioned benefiting from decreased transition time seemed really beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
Things like increasing student independence, decreasing disruptions in the classroom, and then maximizing the overall instructional time. All of those, as a teacher, would certainly be things I would want to have happen. They talked a little bit about antecedent strategies that had been used in the past, such as providing transition signals and warnings for upcoming transitions. They also talked a little bit about class games that had been tried out before, which kind of provided performance feedback to the whole class. And the one that they mentioned was the timely transition game.
Sounds so much fun, actually. I want to do this with my life, basically.
Yeah. It was super simple. I think they had a basket of different times written on them, and the teacher would pull out a card and say, okay, class, this transition, you have 45 seconds to get ready for the next class, and they would sort of try to beat their own score.
Hmm.
It was as simple as that.
Yeah.
But anything, you give anything a name.
Yeah.
It has capitals, a timely transition game, and it's like suddenly super special and exciting. And I was like, yeah, that's awesome. So they talked a little bit about those types of strategies, and they are going to incorporate pieces of those into what they're doing here. The other important piece that they've added to this package for looking at treatment for
for transitions was computer assisted instruction. And the benefit there is that you're hopefully increasing the overall procedural fidelity of the treatment that you're implementing, because they were able to, you know, simplify some of it. The teachers didn't have to keep track of the time. There were built-in prompts for the teachers to make sure that the students were staying on track and to provide praise to them. And also, I think, and they didn't list this specifically, but kids sometimes think that stuff is really cool.
Yeah, they do.
If you can incorporate the whiteboard, or like there was a timer showing on the screen, like that's very exciting. So those were all the pieces that they wanted to look at here.
I just went to do some work at a daycare recently, and I was observing a preschool classroom without the teacher knowing that I was observing them. Uh-huh. And she did the same thing.
You do
it
from like outside the building, you just kind of like peeked in.
Yeah, I was like creepy, put my face against the wall.
I love that at daycares when you do that.
Yeah. From outside, yeah. Yeah. And they actually, side note, because this is what I'm really good at. So there's a new Halloween decoration where it's a creepy man that you can attach to somebody's window that's like doing the little hands by the eyes creepy into the face. And I saw this and I was like, I want to buy it for all of my friends. And you can like stick it to the windows that looks like someone's looking inside. That's what I was doing.
Oh no.
Yeah, totally buying it, because that would be so scary.
That would be really creepy.
But I was watching this preschool teacher and she was doing this, not naming it. Mm-hmm. But she was like, okay, I'm going to set the timer, and then we're going to clean up this area. And she's like, and if you win, everybody gets a surprise. And so she, like, sets the timer, and the kids are, like, going mad. They're like, pick up that block. Pick it up. We can do this. And then they finish, and, like, the timer goes off, and they're all done. And and they're like, what do we get? And she's like, you guys get a high five. And everyone's like, yeah, high five. It was amazing. I was super impressed with her.
And then you got to isolate those high fives for cleaning up, though.
I think she might do something of the sort, because they were, like, so jazzed. One kid was, like, jumping up and down, hands in the air, like, yay! So it was just, like, nice to see.
I love it.
Yeah.
That's great. I hope she never loses her spark.
Me too. She was a young one.
Okay, so like I said, they combined all of those pieces of what has been done in the past together to make their particular treatment package. And the independent variable here was a game that they introduced. It was called Keep Busy and Carry On, or KBCO. And I pictured it being just like those little red signs with the crown on the top. What do those say? Keep calm and carry on. Okay, so this is just keep busy and carry on. That was the only word that they changed. I don't know if they made those signs for the classroom or not.
I think there's a program on Facebook you can make your own keep something and something something signs.
Those were confusing to me, I'm not going to lie. There was a lot of acronyms in this long article.
Computer assisted instruction, they turned into an acronym.
Keep calm and carry on. Yep. CAI.
Yep.
Yeah, that was
a lot of acronyms.
A lot of acronyms, which I understood because they're trying to get down on word count. Mm-hmm. But holy moly, every page I had to like write the acronyms on the top. So I was like, now what is that?
Is that a technical term? Get out my textbook.
All right, so keep busy and carry on was what they were doing, and it combined some pieces of timing the students, transition warnings, and group contingencies, and then it also, like I mentioned, had opportunities for the teachers to sort of have built-in prompts for them as well. And then there were several dependent variables that they were looking at here, including transition times between activities for the students, on-task behavior, both latency to start the new behavior, and then they did a momentary time sample to measure were they on task during the center's activities. And for the teachers, they looked at number of prompts that the teachers gave to the students, and also number of praise statements that they gave to students as well. This was conducted across two different classrooms, and in each classroom, two students were selected based on a teacher report for having difficulty with transitions. For the first grade classroom, the children were 6 years old. It was Leo and Samantha, and they had roughly 3 transitions per day during the center's time. So transitioning to the first activity, from the first to the second, and then from the second out of center's time into something else. And then for the second grade classroom, Mrs. Crane ran the first grade classroom. And for the second grade classroom, Mrs. Stoklasa ran this one, and the children were Jonathan and Jamie. Jamie was a girl. And in second grade...
She probably still is.
She probably still is, yeah. And in second grade, you have 5 transitions because they had 4 centers activities, so mm-hmm. they had to move between all of those.
They didn't just go into detail on the centers, right? I can't remember.
They did, yes.
They did, okay, they did talk about the centers.
Yeah, so they talked about some of them were like worksheets, some of them were independent, some of them were reading, some of them were teacher-led. Mm-hmm. So depending on the classroom, they went into specific what the centers were.
Okay, so the kind of centers that you would hopefully see in most most public schools these days.
Yeah, it was not expected that the kids transitioned independently through all of those activities. There were times when it was time to switch. Mm-hmm. Between the activities, and that was okay. That wasn't the goal. So this was a reversal design, an ABAB design. During baseline, nothing changed. The teachers, told the students when it was time to transition between activities and went about their business as usual.
What I like about this part, though, for baseline, though, is they actually wrote out procedures for the teachers for baseline, and they were like, number one, cue that it's time for transition. Number two, do like you normally do. But I think that's helpful because when you're that you're being, videotaped and watched, you may see some reactivity to teachers. So if it's written down, I think that was a good ploy that they've done. Here is like, now I have to actually do what I normally do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was cool.
It was nice. So following baseline, then they implemented KBCO, keep busy and carry on. Initially, they showed the children an instructional video to sort of show them what was going to happen. But then on all subsequent days, they ran the computer-assisted instruction with the teacher prompts as needed.
I would have really loved here if they did some behavioral skills training as well, because they only gave the instructions, but they didn't do role play on like, okay, what does this appropriate transition behavior look like? Mm-hmm. They see it, but then they didn't get to practice it, didn't get any feedback on it. So I thought that would have been a good extension, for that first part, watch the video, see a model, role play, get some feedback, and then go into this part.
Yeah, that's true. That would have been nice.
Yeah, and I bet it would help the teachers, too, just so that they get a little more practice seeing that procedure, but that was just me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, they're going to get a lot of feedback.
That's true.
The upcoming transition. So when KBCO was in place, the teacher activated she had like a PowerPoint type. I believe, and it projected up onto the whiteboard different instructions.
Even the whiteboard had an acronym.
Oh, yeah, the IWB?
Yeah. I was like, what? Like, come on, guys.
It's an interactive whiteboard. Yeah. That's what it stood for.
But I did love that. I was like, wow, even the whiteboard gets an abbreviation.
Yeah, I had to go back and look what that one was. So a computerized voice came on and said, go to your next center. And at that point in time, a timer came on the whiteboard, and the amount of time they had was randomized, just like in the Timely Transitions game, how long they had to transition between the activities. And once they were at the new activity, then a picture of how long that activity lasted came up onto the screen and counted down the time that remained in that activity. So it was like a 15-minute activity. It would count it down.
And they use the transition mean time for the individuals that they use for the individual participants. So that's how they figured out what the mean time was. It was for the two slowest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. And then as the activity was happening, they added in on-task tones as well. When the tone sounded, the screen showed, are you on task? And it was also served as a cue for the teachers to remind them to give some praise for students who were on task during that time.
And points.
And points, too. Mm-hmm. So it seemed a little counterintuitive to me to have a tone go off if kids were working. It seemed to me like that might be disruptive to them.
Well,
I don't think so.
The one teacher did say that she found the kids to be prompt dependent on the tone. Mm-hmm. So when they did prompt fading, then she just had a little vibrator in her pocket to then look up and make sure that people were on task.
Yeah.
Which I think may be a little more appropriate.
Yeah, I loved that.
I like that only one teacher got that. But I think that would be helpful there, because I also think that tones, if you're working really hard, I think the tone may either serve as a reinforcer for your behavior of working on task, right? Because now you're getting points. or it may serve as a prompt, an external prompt for being on task.
Yeah.
Which you don't necessarily want in life because nobody gets tones. Like, man, could I use a tone at work, right?
Like, yeah, to me it would just be distracting, I think. I feel like if I were working hard, it would take me out of it.
It might, yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
and then I start looking around, I'm like, oh, what's Jimmy doing?
Oh, is everybody else working?
Right, who else is not happy?
So that might be something to think about, you know, if we ever want to extend this literature, is do you actually need that tone? Or can the are you on task visual cue serve as the prompt?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the teacher could have the silent cue.
Yeah. I loved that the second grade teacher, she wanted to fade out
right.
Some of the additional prompts of this treatment package. So for her class, they did a fading component in which the on-task tones were removed. And she just used her iPhone mm-hmm. and kept track of like every 5 minutes or so. She would have it vibrate and then she would provide praise to the students.
Smarty yeah. pants teacher.
I know, I thought that was awesome. And yes, there was a point system involved. It was a little complicated.
It was.
It read as kind of a, like, 10 points for Gryffindor type thing where it seemed a little bit random. But
still have not read Harry Potter, so don't know.
Oh, man, we're going back through the whole series. So it's fresh in my mind.
Nice.
It's pretty much just an ill-defined reinforcement system
right.
/ response cost system. So great job. You saved the castle. Have 72 points. Uh-oh, you were out of curfew. Lose a bajillion points.
They didn't lose any points, though.
No.
That's the Harry Potter. This is the Harry Potter system.
Okay, I was like, oh,
it's
no.
It's just arbitrary, you know. At the end of the book, Harry Potter has to win. So how many points would he need for that?
Yeah. No, the students were divided into groups. And so some of the groups contained the students who were actually the target students. So it depended on which groups met the criteria. They got to color in different colors on a thermometer.
But they, and then when
the thermometer was filled up, they got extra recess.
But they didn't target the two participants. The only thing, they just used that for the meantime. Everyone could still earn the same amount of stuff.
But those students weren't singled out. It was a group contingency.
It was just the means. It was the only thing that really was.
Yeah. And it was an interdependent group contingency, mm-hmm. meaning that all of the students had to meet criteria in order for the group to get the reinforcer. Mm.
Yes.
Just putting it out there.
No, that's, I like.
If we're going to get our task list done, define interdependent grouped contingency.
Thank you, Jackie.
That's
You're
good.
Welcome. Feeling smart today.
Love it. So overall, this went well. They also looked at procedural fidelity. I should make sure that I mention that.
Right.
And while the overall level of procedural fidelity was high, the teachers implemented this with about 95%, give or take. There were a few components that they implemented at a little bit lower level than maybe what you might look for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was, well, the piece of it was providing the feedback, the positive feedback and praise part, where they were averaging more like 70 to 80% of the opportunities when they could have provided praise, did they?
And the lowest was like 48.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is pretty low.
Yeah, but
it happens.
You know, we'll talk about the results of the study, and overall these results did look pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
You have to kind of think about whether that piece is really problematic or not. I guess we don't know. But, you know, even providing praise in, let's say, 60 to 70 to 80% of opportunities is likely much higher than what happens in a classroom where you don't have a contingency like this set up. So to me, that's still pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And it was higher than in baseline.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's important. What is it, like 340%? Higher or 240% higher?
It was
340% higher. I was like, oh yeah, serious. So I mean, this I really liked this, and I wondered if I wanted to do more with the teacher behavior, because I think mm-hmm. you're not really, maybe you're, of course you're shaping students' behavior because
mm-hmm.
we saw increased time on task, we saw shorter transition times for the students, but I really wanted to get more at like teacher behavior because I think having just external cues to prompt teachers to, you know, provide prompts, provide feedback. I just think that's, like, really fascinating and how long it would last, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it worked now.
Yeah.
But will they turn that IWB on every day, you know, interactive whiteboard? Will they, you know, will this have some lasting effects? Or will it some those visual cues lose their potency?
Well, I wonder that for the students as well.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Which we don't
We don't have. Yeah.
But this, there are probably many other behaviors that this could be used for
oh, yeah.
teachers too. We're really just talking about like subtle prompting mechanisms for teachers, just in trying to manage that type of classroom. And you know, we've all been in classrooms and seen how the kids who act out end up getting the most attention.
Oh yeah,
and that's just the nature of trying to manage a large group.
Oh yeah,
like this. So that's maybe a topic for another day.
And keep everyone safe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I don't know. I really loved that Mrs. Stoklasa like took it upon herself to work on fading out some mm-hmm. of the mm-hmm. more cumbersome pieces of this treatment package. I thought that was really awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And they did like it. They had great social validity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's good.
That part looked good. Yeah. So to talk more specifically about the results for the students, for the first grade class, we had Leo and Samantha, and we were looking at their mean latency in seconds to begin the new tasks and percentage of intervals that they were on task. And both of them followed a pretty similar pattern. When we looked at latency to respond, baseline levels were much higher. It was between 200 and 300 seconds for both of them, which I think works out to 5 minutes.
Mm.
Between Let me get my calculator. Minutes, right? So I'm going to do 400 divided by 60.
It's like,
I don't know.
400
7
seconds.
Times 6 is 42. So
400 divided by 60 seconds is 6.67.
Oh. Okay. Wow, that's really long.
Minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there were times in baseline where Leo was taking 6 minutes to transition between centers activities. That's a really long time.
Yeah.
That's really long.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And Samantha was right up there with him. So once KBCO, our treatment package, was implemented, latency to respond dropped down much, much lower to between 1 to 2 minutes.
I was like,
per activity.
I'm ready with my calculator.
You're ready? I got it now. I got it.
Okay.
Re-implementation of baseline saw levels rise right back up to where they were previously, and then they put the treatment back in place and they saw levels decrease again to about 1 to 2 minutes to start the activity. And then looking at time on task when they were engaged in the activity, baseline levels were relatively low, around 30% for Leo and 40% for Samantha when the KBCO was implemented. Initially, rates rose right away up to about 75%.
Right.
However, they ran 4 sessions in the treatment and they saw for both participants, and this is really interesting, a pretty clear decreasing trend across those 4 sessions. Back down, it was still higher than baseline, but it was back down to about 50% by the end of those 4 sessions. And I have to think that that's what you're talking about, Jackie, is
right.
just that novelty of, oh, wow, it's something new. Like,
right.
let's look at the IWB and see what the timer is and am I on task? Like, that's really exciting initially, and that excitement starts to wear off after even just 4 sessions. So that does
right.
leave me a little bit curious as to what would happen with this
if
long-term.
You did a follow-up, like a 1-month to a 3-month follow-up. And if teachers even, I mean, it seems, even though it doesn't seem like a lot of work, you still have to turn it on and start it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have your time, you know, it's like time till the task is over. Now your behavior is governed by that timer.
Yeah.
You know, so in a third grade classroom or in a first grade classroom, it's less likely that you're going to be changing teachers, right? So, like you're working on math and maybe you work on math a little bit longer because
yeah.
you're like doing something else and then you move to English.
Mm-hmm.
But now you can't. With this, you have to stay within the confines of that task. So I'm wondering.
Well, I think this is less for the teacher, like the lecture time.
Right, but still.
The center's time. But yeah.
Because one of the center time was teacher-led.
Mm, true.
Yeah, so I don't know. I thought about that, too. I was like, ooh, I have to get in that time frame. That's hard.
Yeah. And then to follow up the reversal to baseline, they saw lower levels and then higher levels. It actually maintained. They did not see, when they re-implemented the KBCO, they did not see the decrease that they saw previously. They saw levels maintain at a pretty stable rate that was higher than baseline, so that was good. And then our other two guys, Jonathan and Jamie, the girl, we saw similar patterns as to what we're seeing with Leo and Samantha. Latency was lower for this group.
Mm-hmm.
They were older. So that was good.
Yeah.
Right. So their baseline levels of latency to begin the tasks for Jonathan was around 200. You want to do that math for me? 3 minutes?
Yeah.
Three and a half minutes. Yeah. And for Jamie, she actually had some varying rates between 100 seconds and 300 seconds. So it was a little bit different.
Cool.
For her. But it was on an increasing trend. When they implemented the treatment, latency dropped really low.
It's awesome.
Which was awesome to see. And return to baseline saw levels increase back up to higher levels. However, there was one asterisk there that they noted that they had extra observers in the classroom.
Right.
So they thought that Jamie was reacting to their presence. So that data point was probably one that they wished that they could chuck. And then remember, this was the group that they also did the fading for. So they put the treatment back into place, faded it out, and saw that latency stay really nice and low.
That's good.
Perfect. They also looked again at the on-task percentages, and that was similar pattern to what we saw with the other two guys, particularly for Jonathan. Again, baseline rates were lower for on-task behavior. Putting the treatment into place, we saw an increase. But then Jonathan had that exact same decreasing trend that the other two guys did, less so for Jamie. So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Removal saw behavior drop back down, and then reimplementation of treatment saw levels of on-task behavior stay high, even with fading. So that was good.
Yeah, I like that.
Yep. And then finally, to talk about our two teachers, Mrs. Crane and Mrs. Stotlasa.
You love that name.
I do.
You just keep wanting to say it. I say it
every single time. So they were looking at two things here. Frequency of teacher prompts to stay on task or start being on task, and frequency of teacher praise. So for Mrs. Crane, the teacher prompting was fairly high in baseline. It reduced with using KBCO, returned to almost this high levels as the initial baseline in the return to baseline condition. And then in the follow-up treatment condition, we saw number of teacher prompts stay relatively low, which was good to see. And then for Mrs. Stotlasa, very similar pattern, almost exactly identical, in fact, pattern to Mrs. Crane. And she was able to keep the number of teacher prompts pretty low, even with the fading.
So right.
That was great. And then looking at teacher praise, this level was pretty low overall for Mrs. Crane.
For both, really.
Although
until the end.
For Mrs. Stotlaska, she really seemed to increase it over time. So she had lowest levels in both of the baseline conditions. And then for her KBCO and fading, it just continued to increase how much teacher praise she was providing, which is kind of nice.
Right. One of
it seemed like she really embraced this. You know?
Yeah,
like,
she really did.
I loved that about her.
The author suggested that maybe her praise increased because she was delivering less prompts. So it gave her more opportunity to praise specific behavior, so that's something interesting to think about.
Yeah, and she's seeing the benefit
right
so her praising was being reinforced
right
by having students stay on task.
Yeah
Cool. All right, I think that's what I had to say about the results.
Good.
I really liked this study. I thought it was a nice way to look at this type of problem in a classroom. And while they were only addressing the behavior of two particular students, we didn't get data on the rest of them, which was a limitation. It would be easy to see how this would likely extrapolate out to the whole classroom. When they were talking about the results, what I also found just shocking was that they looked at the time that was saved using this treatment package for the students, and across the two classrooms, it averaged 39 minutes per week that the students were no longer spending in. Oh, I have it.
Oh, I was like,
I was pulling out
my calculator. I was like, ooh,
math time. 39 minutes per week that the students were now going to be able to engage in additional instruction time. Yeah. What number are you coming up with there?
So I did 39 minutes times 52 weeks,
and
I got 2,028 minutes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, students aren't in school all 52 weeks.
I know, but that is 33 hours.
Yeah. So they said across the school year, it would be 3 additional 7-hour school days.
Wow.
Of instructional time.
That's amazing.
I know. Right?
Yeah.
I was looking for time, ways to eke out time in 3 full days.
Right. That's serious.
Yeah.
It's a lot. I know.
That's like a whole, like you can have like 3 whole different parties.
Day-long
parties. Day-long Ragers. Parties. Where you watch movies and eat popcorn.
Yeah, they don't let you have any food anymore,
though. Oh, just kidding. Where you watch movies.
Yeah, they might let you still do that.
Okay.
So, cool. Yeah, to me, that, like, once it was taken to that level, I was like, oh, my gosh. KBCO.
I love those levels.
Really works.
For it's this cool. particular. And
what we don't know is whether right. it would continue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Who would think that such a quick little change could actually produce that much benefit? I liked it. I liked it a lot.
Well, I think it's about time to pull into Dissemination Station. My train needs a tune-up. That was a...
My train, just like my car, is breaking down.
So what do we want to say, I think, about our take-home point for this talk about transition?
So I think my take-home point is that if you want to do the best job that you can looking at why problem behavior is occurring in transitions, I think you need to do both a assessment on consequences as well as modify some antecedents. And I think using those together may provide your best outcome because you may not get great results in one or the other or may not be efficient in engaging in some sort of assessment due to your constraints of where you work.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can't do functional analysis in public school necessarily. So here you'd be like, okay, I might do an assessment on what consequences I may think may maintain problem behavior, change the antecedent, also add in some additional consequences that may help strengthen alternative behavior. And I think that would be your best bet.
All right.
Nice. That sounds good. For me, I'm hearkened back to our pre-session pairing episode with Dr. Amanda Kelly. Because, I mean, that actually involved transitions as well. So sure. Maybe that's kind of why I'm thinking of it. But this is one of those areas, as is, I think, transitioning a child to the work station, where you can end up having the approach of, well, this just has to happen.
Right.
And this is what it is. And this kid doesn't like transitions. This kid doesn't like going to work. And that just is what it is. And I'm just going to have to kind of like push on through this. And to me, the types of articles that we talked about here and also the concept of pre-session pairing just present it in a whole new light. That it doesn't have to be this way. There are a lot of things that we can do if we really stop, slow down, take our time, look at what's going on here, and make usually some pretty simple modifications. I guess that's my take-home point, is if you're seeing that transitions are problematic for your student, then likely there are just a few things that you could do if you're thinking about it from a functional perspective.
Right. As you started to do today, when you're thinking, you were like, oh, wait, I probably should be doing something different.
Right.
So there you notice in your life when you step back and take an objective look that, oh, this is something that I actually have control over.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And it's not something I have to live with.
Exactly.
That's a really good way to put it.
Yeah, yeah. I like that. I am going to actually try to incorporate these types of situations in my everyday life this week when I have to go from preferred activities such as my couch and hot cider and dogs to non-preferred activities. And maybe I'll wait and drink my hot cider at work to make the transition maybe a little more preferred. Do some antecedent.
Pre-Mac principle there?
Yeah. I might do a little antecedent-based strategies where if I come to work and I get to work in like a timely fashion, something can happen. Like maybe I can get French fries for lunch or, you know, like maybe add in some more reinforcer to my non-preferred situation. Because I think for me, really, it's changing activities or changing locations.
Mm-hmm.
Because once I get there, I'm fine. Right, but it's the getting there that's a challenge. So
yeah, that often is. I know for me, it's the same thing. If I could just snap my fingers, like, I'm sleeping. Oh, but now I'm awakened at work. Hooray. I wouldn't mind it at all.
Right, so maybe I just need to do some modifications. And I actually love my job, so it isn't the fact that going to my job is aversive. It's actually going.
It's the physical movement through space.
And I think what would be really interesting, too, is to take these concepts that we've talked about today and apply them to typical adult behavior and see, you know, how much more we can affect change in, like, work productivity if we looked at it in terms of, you know, how can I increase my efficiency by decreasing on my transition times from breaks, from lunch, from even from one activity to the next, modify my Facebook time. Right? So,
well, they, and of course I don't, can't remember all the details, but they are talking about how even at work, how long can, does the average person stay on one task?
Right.
It's very short.
Oh yeah.
Without going and like checking your email is the main thing.
So I think it would be interesting.
I think they recommend turning off your email and just setting up certain times during the day where you're going check it.
Yeah, that seems really smart.
It's really easy to get distracted and you get a new email and it seems like something you have to respond to right away when it probably really isn't.
Yeah.
But it completely takes you out of your train of thought
of
what else you were trying to accomplish.
Yeah. So this is, I think this is just an interesting area that we could do a lot, you know, not only with the kids that we work with, but, you know, our own kids. Not mine, but Diana's and everyone else's. And, you know, like I've been thinking about how I could use this with the preschool that I consult to. You know, what kind of strategies can I then teach the teachers to help their job be more effective and efficient, even though it doesn't seem like a lot because it's preschool.
Yeah.
Like they're like 3 and 4 and they're just jumping around. But like how can I make it better, you know, for the teachers? So it's just interesting.
Yeah. Good.
You guys should write in and tell us what your thoughts are on how you can make your transitions better. So you should Facebook us. Look, I'm being robbed right now. You could Facebook us, you know, how you've tried to improve your transitions or send us an email. Because I'd actually be really interested in knowing, you know, what people are doing.
I think there's a lot more to be done in this area.
Absolutely.
It's something we all work on.
Yeah.
In our own lives and with the students that we work with and... probably a lot more that we can explore.
So fun.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jay. You did our social media plug, so I don't have to do that now.
You can also find us on Twitter.
Yeah, that's true.
Snitcher, iTunes, YouTube.
We're everywhere. It's ABA Inside Track.
.com.
The only thing I want to make sure that I disseminate is our second secret code word for those of you applying for CEs. And I was going to do a crazy acronym, but that seems too hard. So let's just use CARRY as our second code word. C-A-R-R-Y.
Oh.
CARRY.
CARRY.
CARRY. Like the original keep calm, yada, yada.
Stephen King?
One. What? No.
Oh. It is Halloween time. I know. It's Oh, CARRY. Oh. I get it.
Yeah, so not CARRY who can blow up the prom.
Oh.
CARRY, like I'm going to pick something up.
Okay.
And carry on. C-A-R-R-Y.
Obviously, we don't talk about our secret carry code on. Words before this because I'm thinking like pig's blood.
No, we prefer them to happen just organically.
Right. That's pretty funny. I'm glad it's more carry on.
Yeah. And next episode, it'll be pig and blood. We'll be the two words, I think. Just a preview.
That's awesome. Okay.
Well, everyone, thanks for listening. Jackie already told you where you can find us online. Everywhere is ABA Inside Track. And like she said, write in with any ideas you have for transitions. And Jackie, I know you have another plug you always want to throw in there.
I always want to throw in that I love teaching people about behavior analysis. I love it. It's my passion. It's my job. And I want to teach you out there, you in your car, you with your seatbelt on. You in your living room with your dogs and hot apple cider.
And seatbelt.
And seatbelt on your couch. You know, sometimes you need a seatbelt on your couch. It's fine.
That's right. It's probably why it's so hard for you to get to work. You gotta take the seatbelt off. Right? This is so many extra steps.
I just don't want to fall off the couch, guys. I just don't want to fall off.
Safety first.
Yeah. I want you, Y-O-U, finger pointing, to have a career in behavior analysis. And I want to teach you. So I want you to check out our master's in behavior analysis at Regis College. We also have a certificate in applied behavior analysis. If you already have a degree in another area, like special education, come on down. We would love to see you. We have part-time and full-time options. Really awesome faculty other than myself. I'm not calling myself awesome, but other people are awesome.
You are awesome.
Well, thanks. Diana thinks I'm awesome. So, but if you are interested, please check us out at regiscollege.edu.
Excellent.
Well, everyone, thank you so much for listening. If you were at the Babbitt conference, would have been about that just recently happened, and you came up and said hi to us, thank you very much. It was nice of you to do so. If you didn't, well, I hope you just weren't there or couldn't find us or were very busy or something, because our feelings were probably hurt.
Right, because I work the CEU desk, so I saw all of you. Every single one of you.
So for anyone who could not go to the conference and say hi, you can just say hi. You don't have to say we're great or anything. You can say that if you want. That'd be nice. But for anyone who hasn't seen us or who just likes listening from afar on the podcast machines, we'll be back next week with our preview episode where we'll be talking about what our next exciting topic will be. But until then, keep responding. Bye.
See ya.